complete way.
Aperture.
On April 26, 1986, the worst nuclear accident in history occurred when a reactor exploded at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine, releasing 90 times the radioactivity of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As whole towns were evacuated in a matter of hours, the radiation left a devastating trail everywhere it touched. In hospitals, schools, playgrounds, entire villages, and the life of every single person present in the town on that day. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Now, 3 decades after the accident, Chernobyl, the once devastated ghost town, has become a tourist destination with its own thriving cafe. With the passage of time, and despite the dangerously high levels of radiation, the fears of the older generations have been replaced by the fascination of the new. Popularized in video games and horror movies, the Chernobyl nuclear reactor is now an attraction for travelers from all over the world, and tourism agencies are thriving. This week on Aperture, we will go to Chernobyl to see how life is finding its way back to the town. Stay with us.
She was naked.
On the 26th of April, 1986, at approximately 1:24 a.m., reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear plant starts melting.
Мы впервые реально столкнулись с такой грозной силой, какой является ядерная энергия, вышедшая из-под контроля.
A significant amount of radioactive material is projected for several days in the air, affecting all forms of life in a radius of 500 kilometers around the plant.
На сегодня 299 человек госпитализированы с диагнозом лучевой болезни разной степени тяжести.
Tens of thousands of liquidators clean up radioactive waste that is scattered at the site and the surrounding areas just after the explosion. Their protections are insignificant, and they are exposed to doses of lethal radiation. Most of them will die or end up disabled.
Выражаю глубокое сочувствие семьям, родственникам погибших, трудовым коллективам, всем, кто пострадал от этой беды, кого постигло личное горе.
An area of 30 kilometers around the plant is closed and totally drained of its 115,000 inhabitants. Chernobyl is and will remain radioactive for thousands of years. Years after the disaster, what is it that drives man to come back to this contaminated land? At about an hour and a half drive from Kiev, the checkpoint Dityatki marks the entrance into the 30-kilometer forbidden zone. Access is strictly regulated, and the army controls every entrance and exit. At first glance, we see that nature is very present. In 1986, Chernobyl City had about 1,300 inhabitants, and officially today, there are none. Despite all this, grass is mowed, and houses are maintained, and you quickly forget where you are. But the devil is in the details. All is calm, almost frozen, yet there are signs of life, attempts to make daily life more colorful and joyful. In fact, about 600 people live and sleep here in Chernobyl. Most of them are working on the building of the new sarcophagus that will soon cover the plant. They're allowed to stay for 15 days in the area, but then they must leave for the next 15 days. This is the rule in order to not exceed the radiation dose. The new water pipes were not buried in order to avoid contact with the radioactive ground. So the pipes are apparent. Sometimes you have to step over them. And sometimes they're the ones that cross over you. And all of a sudden, at certain hours, life starts up again. Cars go by. People walk home or ride their bikes. Here, combat clothes are the fashion. It's as if everyone was at war against the invisible enemy. Radioactivity in the city is near to normal. In subdivisions, homes were abandoned immediately after the disaster. People left everything. Some people have returned and have put their homes back in order. They furnish them and they live there, but they still follow the rule of 15 days in the area, 15 days out. In these neighborhoods, life is modest, and for a few hundred euros, you can buy a small house with a garden and enjoy the tranquility of a true country house. A small community coexists, and social life is slowly growing. In 2013, a cafe opened in the heart of the city of Chernobyl. Before 1986, these premises housed a large municipal canteen. The establishment was called Canteen No. 10, and the cafe was christened Cafe 10. Coincidence or destiny, it's 10 kilometers from the plant. It is open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., and every day, 30-some people have a drink or eat Ukrainian specialties on the menu. Several devices continuously measure radioactivity. The cafe also offers rooms worthy of a good hotel in Kiev. Sergei, the boss, made a bargain when he settled here. The cafe employs 10 people. They're all aware of the risks and have thought long and hard before coming to work here. More and more tourists come eat in the cafe. They rub shoulders with the plant workers. Noon is the rush hour. With time in the zone being limited, service must be fast and efficient. Everyone releases stress and anxiety. Coming to Chernobyl is far from trivial. The cafe even has its gift shop. In the afternoon, the tourists leave Chernobyl and hit the road to the city of Pripyat. Fresh out of Chernobyl, we must go through a new military checkpoint. We enter the 10-kilometer zone around the plant. The Red Forest, this is the name given to the 400 hectares of pines that once surrounded the plant. After the accident, the trees turned red because of the radioactive radiations. The whole forest was bulldozed and buried. Today, the new arch construction is visible from afar. It will replace the old sarcophagus, and it will entirely cover the plant. The radioactivity here is alarming. In the inside of a car, it is 50 times above normal. You do not stop. Doses are much higher on the ground. A few kilometers further north, the road splits into two. A monument points to the one that leads to the city of Pripyat. One must cross the Bridge of Death. The day after the disaster, the inhabitants of the city gathered here to watch the plant burning. On this bridge, they all received lethal doses of radiation. On April 27th, 1986, at dawn, The city of Pripyat was still asleep. The white flashes visible in these images are due to radiation. The plant's been burning for over 20 hours now, and the population still doesn't know what's going on. The military rushed here, crossed by the first early risers of the population. But nothing is said. It's Sunday. People go out. 3 kilometers away, helicopters hover above reactor number 4. They try to extinguish the flames and limit releases of iodine, cesium, and tellurium that spread continuously in the air. Every hour, the army measures radioactivity around the city. The counters are panicking. At this rate, the lethal dose is reached within 4 days. Precisely 49,360 people live here. In a few hours, the lives of these people will be shattered. 1,200 buses and 200 trucks will arrive in the main square. It'll only take 3.5 hours to empty the city. The loudspeakers make the announcement. One may only take bare necessities. Identification papers, change of clothing, and some food for the trip. It is forbidden to take animals. The voice on the loudspeaker says that this is a temporary evacuation. The first buses enter the city early in the afternoon. People leave their apartments and entrances of buildings are locked behind them. Some faint and others vomit. Most of them are already heavily irradiated. By late afternoon, the city's deserted. The families will be rehoused in social apartments in Kiev. They will be rejected and abused. No one wants to live near contaminated neighbors. Those that left for 3 days would in fact never return. Pripyat is now completely surrounded by barbed wire, and access to the city is guarded by one man. Pripyat is now populated with trees. They grow everywhere. Most plants have adapted, and their DNA has mutated. They have many structural defects, tumors and malformations. It's not spectacular, but degeneration has become the norm. The land is less contaminated in the area, because each year, radionuclides sink deeper into the ground. However, these plants absorb radioactive particles by their roots, which then grow to the surface. Moss, leaves and flowers are contaminants. The Pripyat swimming pool has become one of the most visited places in the city since it appeared in a famous video game. Some come from far away just to see it for real. Built to accommodate the families of those who worked at the plant, the town provided everything one could wish for at the time. Right next to the pool is the trace of an old courtyard of one of the 5 schools. 1,000 students studied here. On the ground floor, the canteen is strangely empty. Even the heavy cast iron radiators are gone. Looters came and took everything that was valuable. A little further, hundreds of children's gas masks litter the ground. Each school had its own stock, in anticipation of a possible U.S. nuclear attack. In reality, they were never used. The looters are the ones who threw them there. Time is frozen in the corridors. The patriotic newspaper of April 23rd is still on display. In some classrooms, it feels like the day after the disaster. Sometimes realism is a bit too forced and disturbing. Some objects seem to have been moved and staged for tourists' photographs. The city has the most contaminated spots in the whole area, yet it attracts more and more people. In the hospital, you can still find clothes left by the liquidators on the day of the disaster. This is one of the most radioactive places in the world. Yet some visit it unprotected, risking exposure to lethal doses. The area is often compared to a nature reserve, thanks to the great diversity of flora and fauna that are present. Hunting and fishing are prohibited in the little port of Pripyat. The last moored boat has almost finished sinking. It's difficult to imagine that life once swarmed here. Hundreds of people came every weekend to go sailing or picnicking. In this tavern at the water's edge, Serge Dityarenko has been a guide in the area for 5 years. His work is his passion. But he admits that being here is also a form of fighting defeat. The Ukrainian army is fighting to keep its land and border from Russia, whereas here we are in the process of taking back soil contaminated by the former USSR. An amusement park should have been opened 4 days after the disaster, yet the Ferris wheel was started the day after the explosion to keep the locals busy and avoid panic before the evacuation. It became the symbol of the city. This is the inescapable cliché. The authorities and tour operators want reassurance regarding the doses of radiation that tourists are exposed to. But nobody knows the real impact of such visits on the body. So-called black or morbid tourism is on the rise. Travel agencies have seized this opportunity. There are more and more tourists, but the former inhabitants of the city rarely want to come back.
This is
this
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
Farmud Boristo.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salam alaikum, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batool. Welcome to the program for a better life. The question that I would like to ask you is, what is a better life? What do we mean by a better life? Is it having a big house, a nice car, a nice job, a beautiful spouse, a good bank balance? If the answer is yes, then why do we see people who possess all this are still striving for more and more and more and more? They're not satisfied at all. In my opinion, the key to a better life is being happy. Now, how can a person reach happiness? A person might be wealthy, but still not happy. So what is the secret to happiness? The secret is to have God in your life. So, how can I have God in my life? We can have God in our lives by making our actions, our thoughts, our intentions godly, by maintaining piety, by acquiring virtues, and cleansing ourselves from all the vices. This will lead to eternal bliss. The first step is to clean ourselves from inside, to discipline ourselves. Once we are purified, then we can replace our vices with virtues. So, now, the question is, how do I purify myself? How do I discipline myself? Is there a plan? Are there any guidelines for it? Yes, the ulama of akhlaq have given a few pointers. But before that, I would like to pose a few questions. Question one. Now, how is a society formed? The answer is with families. Next question. How are families formed? Families are formed with individuals like you and me. So if you and I, we correct ourselves, the society will automatically be corrected. If we bring that change in ourselves, that will lead to the change in the society, which in turn will lead to happiness, the eternal bliss, the better life. So, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. Imam Ali alayhis salam said, "Man lam yuslih nafsahu, lam yuslih ghayrahu." One who cannot correct himself cannot correct others. So how do we correct ourselves? What are the steps towards it? The first step is called yaqda. Yaqda is derived from the root word yaqd, which means to awaken, to have awareness. In Irfan, it means to wake up from a deep slumber, which results in lightening of the heart with the godly light, to turn towards Allah by turning away from this world.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We are all awake, but this awakening that I'm talking about is something else. Prophet said, "Annasu niyam, fa idha matu intabahu." People are sleeping. When they will die, they will wake up. And when they will wake up, they will never sleep again. But it will be too late, as a matter of fact. It will be like the last train has left. Oh Allah, send me back, send me back. I'll do some good deeds. I'll give me another chance. Then Allah will say, "Innaha kalimatun huwa qailuha." He's just saying. He doesn't mean what he's saying. These are mere words. That is why, brothers and sisters, we should wake up before it is too late. Sometimes an incident might awaken a person. For example, he loses a loved one, God forbid. Or there is some loss in his business, in his work, a layoff, or a disease, or an awakening sentence from a pious one. Ayatollah Amini writes in his book, Self-Building, that Abu Basir narrates. Abu Basir gives us this story where he says, "One of the agents of a tyrant king used to live in my neighborhood, who used to acquire his living through illegal means. That means he used to have all his living through haram and had turned his home into a center of carnal pleasures. What did he mean by that? That means there was dancing, drinking, music. Then Abu Basir continues. He says, living next door to him was annoying and painful for me, but there was no alternative except to bear, because my repeated advices had not have any impact in his behavior. There was no improvement at all. Finally, one day, when I pressed him hard to change his lifestyle, he replied, I am a prisoner of Satan. Because of my addiction to eating, drinking, and sinning, I cannot quit it. I am a sick person, and I have no treatment. You are a good neighbor to me, but I am a bad neighbor for you. I am helpless, and have become a prisoner of self-whims and passions, and don't know what to and how to get myself out of this. See, brothers and sisters, don't we do that? Don't we make excuses when we don't want to stop sinning? When we have a bad habit, we always look for excuses. This is what that neighbor was doing. And then Abu Basir continues his story. He says that the neighbor told him, he said, when you visit Imam As-Sadiq in the near future, please plead my case to him. Maybe he will suggest a solution. Then Abu Basir continues. He says, I was deeply influenced with his words and remained patient for a while till an opportunity arose for me to go to Medina for seeing Imam As-Sadiq. When I saw Imam Al-Salam, I told him the story of my neighbor. The Imam replied, when you return, your neighbor will come to see you. Then you must tell him that Ja'far ibn Muhammad had said, do not commit sins and I will guarantee paradise for you. Just imagine, brothers and sisters, isn't that a moving line? It's such a powerful sentence that Imam said. He said, do not commit sins and I will guarantee paradise for you. Now let's see what happened to the rest of the story, like what happened to the neighbor after he heard this, inshallah, in our next session. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A laborer discovered a fossil and hid it in a well for 85 years in Harbin in northern China's province of Heilongjiang during the Japanese occupation. Scientists say it could help sort out the human family tree and how our species emerged. We now present you an article written by The Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled Massive Human Head in Chinese Well Forces Scientists to Rethink Evolution. The discovery of a huge fossilized skull that was wrapped up and hidden in a Chinese well nearly 90 years ago has forced scientists to rewrite the story of human evolution. Analysis of the remains has revealed a new branch of the human family tree that points to a previously unknown sister group, more closely related to modern humans than the Neanderthals. The extraordinary fossil has been named a new human species, Homo longi, or Dragon Man by Chinese researchers, although other experts are more cautious about the designation. Professor Chris Stringer, research leader at the Natural History Museum in London, who worked on the project, said, "I think this is one of the most important finds of the past 50 years," adding, "It's a wonderfully preserved fossil." The skull appears to have a remarkable backstory. According to researchers, it was originally found in 1933 by Chinese laborers building a bridge over the Songhua River in Harbin, in China's northernmost province of Heilongjiang, during the Japanese occupation. To keep the skull from falling into Japanese hands, it was wrapped and hidden in an abandoned well, resurfacing only in 2018 after the man who hid it told his grandson about it shortly before he died. An international team led by Professor Qiang Ji at the Hebei Geo University in China drew on geochemical techniques to narrow down when the skull came to rest in Harbin, dating the bones to at least 146,000 years ago. The skull has a unique combination of primitive and more modern features, with the face in particular most closely resembling Homo sapiens. One huge molar remains. skull, which is 23 centimeters long and more than 15 centimeters wide, is substantially larger than a modern human skull and has ample room at 1,420 milliliters for a modern human brain. Beneath the thick brow ridge, the face has large square eye sockets, but is delicate despite its size. Professor Stringer said this guy had a huge head. The researchers believe the skull belonged to a male about 50 years old who would have been an impressive physical specimen. His wide bulbous nose allowed him to breathe huge volumes of air, indicating high-energy lifestyle, while sheer size would have helped him withstand the brutally cold winters in the region. Professor Shijun Ni, a paleoanthropologist at Hebei Jiu University, said, "Homo longi is heavily built, very robust," adding, "It is hard to estimate the height, but the massive head should match a height higher than the average modern human." To work out where the Harbin individual fitted into human history, the scientists fed measurements from the fossil and 95 other skulls into software that compiled the most likely family tree. To their surprise, the Harbin skull and a handful of others from China formed a new branch closer to modern humans than Neanderthals. The Chinese researchers believe the Harbin skull is distinct enough to make it a new species, but Professor Stringer is not convinced. He believes it is similar to another skull found in Dali County in China in 1978. He said, "I prefer to call it Homo daliensis, but it's not a big deal." Professor Stringer added, "The important thing is the third lineage of later humans that are separate from Neanderthals and separate from Homo sapiens." Details are published in three papers in The Innovation. Whatever the name, one possibility is that the Harbin skull is Denisovan, a mysterious group of extinct humans known largely from DNA and bone fragments recovered from Siberia. Professor Stringer said, "Certainly this specimen could be Denisovan, but we have to be cautious. What we need is much more complete skeletal material of the Denisovans alongside DNA evidence." Professor John Hawkes, a paleoanthropologist at University of Wisconsin at Madison, said the idea of a new lineage of humans was a provocative claim because skulls can look similar even among distant relatives. He added the skull being Denisovan was a good hypothesis, though he was less keen on a new species name. He said, "I think it's a bad moment in science to be naming new species among these large-brained humans that all interbred with each other." He added, "What we are repeatedly finding is that the differences in looks didn't mean much to these ancient people when it comes to breathing." Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London and the author of The Cradle of Humanity, said, "The beautifully preserved Chinese Harbin archaic human skull adds even more evidence that human evolution was not a simple evolutionary tree, but rather a dense, intertwined bush. We now know that there were as many as 10 different species of hominins at the same time as our own species emerged." Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London, added, "Genetic analysis shows that these species interacted and interbred. Our own genetics certainly contained the legacy of many of these ghost species. But what is a sobering thought is that despite all this diversity, a new version of Homo sapiens emerged from Africa about 60,000 years ago, which clearly outcompeted, outbred, and even outfought these other closely related species, causing their extinction. It is only by painstaking research and analysis of their fossils such as the Harbin skull, do we know of their existence?
Africa Today.
Despite an estimated 2,000 languages being spoken across Africa, for many to succeed in the continent, they have no option but to learn English or French, the languages of the countries which colonize most of Africa. Now, experts are warning that this trend might lead to the extinction of indigenous languages. Renowned African writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o says abandoning one's indigenous language is tantamount to enslavement. Let's take a listen.
There's a difference between adding another language to what you already have, which I call empowerment, and what I call the other, where you add many languages. You remove your own language completely, and then you acquire other languages, which I call enslavement. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the dangers that African languages are facing amid rapid globalization, which has seen the dominance of English and French. Our experts will provide an incisive analysis and present possible solutions to this challenge facing African nations, which are fighting to preserve their identity. It will be great hearing from you, so keep in touch through our social media handle.
English, French imperil African languages. Africa has 55 countries that use a variety of languages, including some that are endangered due to several factors, especially the influence of Western culture. Every African language is a repository of history, culture, and values. So when a language dies, so too does history, culture, values, and the sense of identity. African language experts are waking up to the reality that a lack of school reading material in local languages is increasingly sounding the death knell for mother tongues.
With bilingual education, children are more active because they master the language. They are not afraid to speak to the teacher. They communicate better in a local language, a language they know well.
Experts and activists across Africa are now trying to restore the link between the people and their mother tongues. Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Professor Kimani Njogu. He's a Kenyan linguist and a publisher who is also a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages, an organ of the African Union. Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
We also have Mr. Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist based in Kampala, Uganda. Thank you also for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, first tell us, why is it important to maintain indigenous languages in Africa?
Well, you see, languages are carriers of culture. They are also carriers of knowledge, and they are carriers of histories. And this is not particular to African languages or indigenous languages. This refers to virtually all languages of the world. Therefore, when we preserve and develop indigenous African languages, we are, in a sense, appreciating and recognizing their place as carriers of African history or the histories of the African people and their experiences, as well as their knowledge systems and their philosophies and their values and so forth and so on. So the development and the promotion of African languages is part of a whole system of, you know, appreciating knowledge production from the African continent.
Thank you for that, Professor Kimani Njogu.
Love for European languages in Africa comes from the colonial mentality that foreign languages are better than their local languages and are a guarantee for the future. Once young people go to higher education, they abandon their mother tongues, thinking they are archaic, and prefer to speak foreign languages such as French or English.
Now, Mr. Kiza, how has over-reliance on European languages while abandoning local languages affected development in Africa?
We have lost on this freedom of determining our own development path as Africa because the current narrative and agenda of development is informed by the culture and language of the West. So it is important if we are to develop as Africa from our own pace, and often as Africa we have been saying we wish to have Africa solutions to African problems. We cannot have this narrative. We cannot achieve this narrative of having African solutions to African problems when we keep relying on a language which is not ours.
Now, globalization and social media are also driving Africans away from their mother tongues. Many people are also no longer feeling proud to speak their mother tongue, as English and French and other European languages have replaced local languages in homes and schools in many parts of Africa. Now, a Zimbabwean language expert here speaks on the importance of the preservation of indigenous languages. Let's listen.
It's good to share information, exchange ideas, but at the end of the day, who are we? We need to know our identity. We need to actually build on what we know, build on what makes us, you know, Zimbabweans.
Professor Kimani Njogu, now how serious is the threat faced by African languages from European languages, especially English and French?
They are in danger, really, of this suppression and domination by European languages, notwithstanding the fact that they are the ones, that is African languages, they are the ones that are spoken by over 70% or 80% of Africans across the continent. Therefore, the danger here is that the continued domination of indigenous languages or African languages by European languages undermines African histories, African philosophies, and the contribution of the continent to knowledge, global knowledge. And therefore, it's really a very serious issue here.
It's quite clear that European colonial languages have continued to dominate in education, commerce, the media, and interaction between African countries. While international languages are crucial for communication and academic transfer and engagement, the use of indigenous languages ensures that local populations are integrated in the development agenda. Is the use of English and French in most development documents in Africa discriminatory to those who do not understand or actually do not want to use these languages?
African countries are actually, currently we are negotiating the African Continental Free Trade Area, an agreement that is going to unite to bring about an open market, a common market of free movement of goods and services within Africa. But there is actually fighting amongst the Francophone-speaking Africa, the French-speaking Africa, and the English-speaking Africa countries because of the fact that which language takes precedence.
Local languages in Africa, just like in many parts of the world, are the basis for cultural identity and local development. African languages that survived the colonial era are now facing the danger of extinction amid an onslaught by European languages. During a visit to Burkina Faso in 2018, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his strategy to promote his native language, aiming to make it the first language in Africa.
Now, let's go back to Professor Kimani Njogu. Do you think the gradual disregard of indigenous languages in Africa is a deliberate move by imperial powers to wipe out the identity of African people?
Well, let me say this, that the colonial project was always a project of domination and suppression of competing ideas. And therefore, under colonialism, the French deliberately suppressed African languages in their colonies, and the British did the same with regard to African languages, and the Portuguese did the same. Therefore, one could say that the colonial project was a project to deny the African people their identity and the base from which they could recollect their history. And even in situations where these languages were supported, they were not deliberately developed. And this has continued through the post-colonial period.
Now, speaking in 2019 during the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed spoke on the need to preserve, revitalize, and promote indigenous languages.
Almost half the world's estimated 6,700 languages are in danger of disappearing. Many of those belong to indigenous people. With every language that disappears, a world loses a wealth of traditional knowledge and cultural heritage. Education will have a pivotal role to play in ensuring that indigenous people can enjoy and preserve their culture and identity. Intercultural and multilingual education will be necessary to prevent the irreparable loss.
Now, Mr. Kiza, what are some of the urgent measures that need to be taken to ensure that future generations in Africa continue using local languages?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The first one and most critical is human capacity, human capital development. We need to invest in building the capacity of our human resource, of our development policymakers, of our negotiators, especially the young ones, of the development commentators, in ensuring that they speak our own languages, in investing resources in our own universities of higher learning, our own research institutions, to teach in African languages, to teach development from an African perspective and reality is another issue which I think is critical if African countries are to nurture and to bring back the African languages with among the young generations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Africa Kiza, for your insight today. Now we shall take a short break, so don't go away.
English, French, imperil African languages.
In 2019, linguistic history was made after students at the University of Cape Town in South Africa graduated from an indigenous language course with roots that date back more than 200,000 years. The Khoisan are known to be one of the earliest inhabitants of Southern Africa, but their language was largely lost during the colonial period. A student who studied the language in university speaks on her accomplishment.
The course itself was an amazing journey to go on to learn this language that was used by my ancestors, by everyone's ancestors. Definitely made a change in my life, and it makes a change in everyone's life, just even to know a few words out of it.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, what sort of intervention is needed to uplift the indigenous languages in Africa?
No, I think the first place for immediate intervention is to look at the educational system and to ask the question, how can we build a continuity, a continuum between what the child experiences within the community in terms of language and what the child experiences within the educational system? How can we build a continuity in the two experiences?
Renowned African novelist from Kenya, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, didn't deliver his acceptance speech in English when last year he was honored as the 31st recipient of the Catalonia International Prize for his daring and distinguished literary work and defense of African languages. He has been writing in his native Kikuyu language since the 80s after abandoning English. Ngugi wrote a book titled Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature. He explains here on how he made the revolutionary decision to write in his mother tongue.
That I would no longer write my fiction or poetry in English anymore. I was going to write in an African language, and I was going to write in the only language then I knew quite well, which was Kikuyu. I had to do this. I had to find a way of connecting myself to myself, you know, and I had to go against that whole colonial assumption, you know, that people can only know themselves via England, in this case, or via European languages, or via Europe.
In July 2004, Kiswahili was declared the official language of the 55-member African Union, with the then-chairperson Joachim Chissano delivering his entire speech during the AU summit in the language. Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, you earlier talked there about the Swahili or Kiswahili language. As we know, the African Union has adopted Swahili language as one of its official languages. Do you think this language can be used as the lingua franca in Africa?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, first of all, we must commend the African Union for taking the position that Swahili or Kiswahili be adopted as one of its official languages and therefore used at the African Union meetings, at the Pan-African Parliament, and other, you know, fora across the continent. That action is very significant because it makes Kiswahili the only African language that plays that role at the African Union level. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that there is immense hope in the utility